When was your last checkup? No, not you. Although that's important, too. But when was your last vehicle checkup? When it comes to service, nobody knows your Chevy better than your local Chevy dealer. Chevy Drive Chicago. Schedule a service appointment at your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer.
720 WGN, and there you have a bit of Citizen Kane from 1941 Orson Welles. And now we go to the Chicago Tribune, where we have a bit of Corey Remore. Hey, how are you? It's the Remore Report.
I'm great. How are you, John?
I'm doing well. I enjoyed your social media post. You reminded me of Les Grobstein and Lee Elia yesterday.
So many bad words.
I mean, it completely slipped my mind, and you were, as usual, on top of the exciting stuff. So you keep track of that day over there at the Tribune, huh? You know when it's coming up?
Of course.
Yeah. Well, you know, if people, I'm sure most people know what it's about, but on the odd chance that some don't, and on a chance that people want to relive it again, why don't you set it up, Corey? What are we talking about?
Okay, picture this.
I will.
It's Chicago. The Cubs are, I think they had, what, a 5-14 start back in 83. And you have a newer manager by the name of Lee Elia, who had started for the Cubs in 1981. And so he, like so many others, were really frustrated by what was going on with the Cubs. And, of course, people who were showing up at the ballpark were heckling the team and heckling him as a result of their really bad start. And so that all came to a head on April 29th, 1983, after the Cubs lost a game to the Los Angeles Dodgers. And there was, like, fewer than 10,000 fans at Wrigley Field that day. And I believe when he was asked about it by reporters, he answered with a 3-minute diatribe that included something like 50 expletives.
Well, we have a version of that. I don't think we've cut it down from 3 minutes. And of course, you put a beep in there. And you can put a beep in anything, by the way, and people will think there's some sort of obscenity. Even if there wasn't one, you could just, like, if somebody took a recording of what I'm doing right now, and just, or when you were on the, just describing it, and all of a sudden in the middle of what you're saying, you hear beep. Wow, she must have said something. I mean, it's a well-known device to cover up an alleged obscenity over, although in this case, Lee Elia was on a rant, and this is what we have to play it and print it.
That's the part that I love. And
yeah,
print it.
Yeah, that line too, by the way, has lived on in a lot of different other scenarios. Sure. You can kiss my downtown and print it. I don't know. I've said that in some situations. It's been said to me, and usually as a joke, but
right.
Yeah. But that belongs to Lee Elia. And once again, that recording was made by Les Grobstein, man. And our version, obviously, has been beeped up, so to speak, and cut down, because like you said, he went on for over 3 minutes. Man.
Yeah, it was a long time. And it's the type of thing that if Les hadn't recorded it, like, would we believe it? I mean, it seems like Lee Elia was a little bit of a hothead, but yeah, just to, like I said, 50 expletives in there, 30, something like 30 F-bombs. Like, wow. I think if somebody did that today, a baseball manager did that today, it would still be, you know,
well, yeah, but
except it would be on social media.
Media,
everywhere.
Are you
everybody
kidding? Somebody probably, it might even be live streamed. I mean,
that's true.
It's the coverage today would be massive. But back then, it was only less. And think about it. This is sort of ridiculous to say, but the only other way it could possibly have been chronicled is if somebody actually took dictation, so to speak, a reporter of some kind, actually printed out the entire thing in the newspaper, and nobody was going to do that. I mean,
right?
They don't do that. But Les had his tape going, man.
Oh, yeah. It's just what a tape, right? What? Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of famous speeches in history, but
yes, that's right.
That one,
there are.
And you know what's fun to me is just like introducing it to younger generations, because you're right, there are people out there who maybe aren't sports fans, maybe don't follow the Cubs, maybe don't know that it ever happened. So it is fun to find somebody every year and say, hey, have you ever heard this before?
Well, I thought it was great that you kept track. I thought it was great that you kept track of it. And I ran into your post yesterday. I'm like, what do you know? It's that time of year again. Yeah.
Yeah.
Corey Moore. Corey Moore from the Chicago Tribune. We'll be back with more when we come back on 720 WG.
Lindholm Roofing has appointments available now to provide you a complete roofing, siding, gutter, and tuck pointing inspection. Call 773-283-7675 or lindholmroofing.com. Tell them that Lou sent you. Lindholm Roofing. Their family has your family covered.
Yes. The presses are rolling. That's from the 2017 movie The Post, directed by Steven Spielberg. 19 minutes after 8 o'clock. I like to throw in, you know, the iconic newspaper stuff when Corey comes on. You know?
Thank you, John. I love it.
And it adds a little flair. You know what I mean? At least I think so.
Oh, sure. Sure, absolutely. It makes everything seem a little more, like, intense.
Yes, indeed. We're journalists on the scene. The press are rolling. Hold it. You can hear that a word had to come down, I guess, from Catherine Graham, whoever the editor was at the Post at that time, down to the press room, and you hear the word passed down. We're going to roll it, and they hit the whatever that is that starts the presses, and it makes a noise. And you don't get that anymore, do you? I mean,
except when I'm over there. Yeah, I
really?
And I go to Schaumburg like once a week at the printing press. And yeah, there are certain little noises that go. But no, I haven't
really?
Heard anybody scream, stop the presses.
But do they have? I mean, is it? It can't be the same type of presses that we think of in the stereotypical newspaper presses are, is it?
I mean, yeah, everything
really?
Is still run over a press, multiple presses, and it's not just the newspaper that's printed there. It's, you know, the Sun-Times is also printed there. The New York
right.
Times is printed there. There are some circulars, some magazines. So they print stuff day
wow.
and night, all the time, just constantly. So, yeah, it's pretty fascinating.
I would think so. I had no idea. No idea. Corey does the vintage Chicago Tribune, amongst some of the other things and responsibilities over there. And, you know, I really got into this story about what you put up there about the Chicago Bears' first NFL draft pick. Because, of course, the draft was, a couple of weeks ago?
Last week.
Last week. What am I saying? I mean, it gets so much airtime, the draft, the NFL draft. What is it? Four rounds, five rounds, and is it four?
Oh my
it's
gosh,
six,
it's like seven
it's
rounds
six,
now.
Seven,
yeah, it's so many,
and they're all on TV. I mean, ABC ran Saturday afternoon hours and hours and hours of this stuff. I mean,
it's a huge deal. It's huge.
Oh, I know it's a huge deal. It's gotten bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and I guess there must be an audience for it. Because why would they bother to put it on TV if there wasn't an audience? I mean, I can get excited about if a team that like the Bears, for instance, obviously, if
sure.
you know, if they go through a few rounds, but after that, I guess, I mean, the excitement sort of wears off to me anyway because of the repetition, and we're getting deeper and deeper into each round, and I guess the only remaining question is who's last, you know, the
sure
insignificant or in whatever the term they call the final draft pick. But you talk about in this article, the first Chicago NFL draft pick ever. And what a story. I mean,
mm-hmm.
sure. we're going to draft a, allegedly a good player, but you know, you never know how right. the player is going to actually turn out. And this is the first one the Bears ever did. And this player not only was an outstanding player, he was just an outstanding person who was at the forefront of everything in his NFL career, literally until he passed away. Tell us the yeah. story. Tell us the story of this guy. I mean, we're not going to, we might not have enough time for the whole thing right now, but we might.
Oh, sure.
And we'll end it on the other side of the news. Don't worry. Because this is amazing to me. So.
Yeah, let me set it up real quick. So 90 years ago is when the NFL held its first draft. And, John, you talk about all the publicity that it gets now. I mean, there was no story in the Tribune about it. The very first draft in 1936 took place as part of the NFL annual meetings, and that's when they were at that time they were in Philadelphia. And it was pretty much guys just sitting around saying, I'm going to take this guy. I'm going to take this guy. But it did, like I said, there wasn't even a story. There's no like guy like putting on a hat and holding up a jersey. Joe Stidahar, who was the very first pick ever for the Chicago Bears, wasn't even there during the draft. So, I mean, we're talking about how this whole thing was in its infancy. And so Joe Stidahar was a tackle at West Virginia. He was the very first linesman ever drafted. And he came out of West Virginia. He had earned All-American honors. And there was already a guy on the Bears who had gone to West Virginia. And some people thought, well, maybe he tipped Bears owner George Halas off to Joe Stidahar, saying, like, hey, you need to take a look at this guy and think about getting this guy. And so Stidahar was here because back in the day, Chicago had this thing called the College All-Star Game.
Oh,
and so
yeah.
the best players from all over the United States would come here and have workouts, and then there would be a game, and they'd play against a professional team. So you could really see some of these guys on display. This guy was massive. For his day, he was massive. 6 foot four, 233 pounds. He played multiple sports when he was in high school and then in college. And you might remember the very first pick in the very first draft was actually a guy who went to the University of Chicago. His name was Jay Berwanger. He was Heisman Trophy winner. Jay never went on to play professional football, but Joe Stidahar did. And so he, in fact, was one of only 24 players who were drafted in that first draft who actually signed a contract to play with a team. So back then, I mean, we're talking about people choosing not to go into the NFL, choosing to go into business instead because they could make more money doing that than playing in the NFL. But Stidahar, as a rookie, was a second-team All-Pro, and then from there he was first-team for the next 3 years. And like I said, he was a really good linesman. Something, a funny tidbit of him, George Halas, the Bears owner, nicknamed Stidahar Old Faithful because of his pregame ritual, which included him going to the bathroom and getting sick before he played a game. But that was just like what he did. And yeah. so it was expected, like, okay, that's what he's going to do before he hits the field. It's hard to get excited about a linesman, but he was a part of the Bears team in 1940 that beat the Washington Redskins 73-0.
Man.
Yeah. 73
I mean, how do you put up 73 points in a professional game? That was a championship game, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Yeah, yeah, it was
I mean,
championship game.
73
yeah,
to nothing.
December.
By the
yeah.
way, you know, you described, you know, it impressed me about how the, well, obviously the professional ranks of the NFL have changed drastically from then until now, but physically, you described yeah. him and he would be, I don't even know what he would be, a defensive back now. What was he? 6'4 and 200 and what? 30, 40 pounds?
33 pounds.
I mean, that's
yeah.
like, you know, you wouldn't be on the line by any stretch of the imagination in the NFL today because there'd be people in there that were literally just about twice your weight. I mean,
right.
come on.
Right.
I mean,
massive.
It just goes to show you how the size of the player has changed over the years. That's incredible. Anyway.
They're intimidating.
But he, even though his arc, his story arc, if you will, as a professional football player and a member of the Chicago Bears, never really stops, does it?
No. He just keeps going and keeps going. And I forget how many seasons he played for. And we're talking about at a time when guys would leave the NFL to go fight in World War II to enlist. And then he, which is what he did, he signed with the Navy. And after 2 years of service, he came back. And so while he was with the Bears, the team won 3 NFL championships, 5 Western Division titles. He was with the Bears for 9 seasons. And after that, he decided to become a coach. And he ended up coming back to coach the Cardinals for a little bit, came back to coach on the defensive line for the Bears. And he was doing that, and he also had a full-time job.
Amazing.
He worked for a packaging company. He was a salesman for a packaging company. And it, after I wrote this story, I actually heard from a couple of people who said, I met him because he would come to my father's business to sell packages. So, I mean, it was just a totally different time in the NFL. And he ended up being accepted into the Hall of Fame in 1967. So, yeah, just fascinating career.
It's Corey Moore, and we're going to do more with Corey, he said, when we come back. But right now it's the bottom of the hour, time to get into the WGN newsroom. 720 WGN, John Landecker at 8:35. We're with Corey Moore from the Chicago Tribune. The Moore Report is what we call this. And Corey spends a lot of time going through the Chicago Tribune archives for a weekly in-your-mailbox vintage Chicago column, article, whatever you want to call it. And you did a great job there telling about Chicago's first draft pick. But one of the other very interesting things that I saw that you put together was how the city has welcomed homed American astronauts. And the arc of the city involvement starting back in March 30th, 1965. So we just recently had, you know, an event that NASA put people up around the moon and they came back and it got a lot of publicity and it was successful and it, you know, it was a relatively big deal, but nothing compared to what things were like initially when NASA started putting people up near the moon on March 30th, 1965. Gus Grissom and John Young, according to your article, spent 4 hours, 52 minutes, and 31 seconds orbiting the Earth 3 times. And what happened then when they came? I mean, when they came down and came to Chicago, it was unbelievable. Tell us about it.
Oh, yeah. So this was the Gemini 3 mission in 1965. It was the first crewed flight of that specific program. And, I mean, like a week after these guys splashed down, they were in Chicago. And so there was a parade for them, a motorcade. And, of course, Mayor Daley was sitting in the front seat, and these guys were sitting in the back seat of a convertible. And people were waving and cheering for them. And I think they stayed at the Drake, and there was a kind of an interesting program. The astronauts actually went to a hotel where there were a bunch of students gathered, and they could ask the astronauts questions. I thought that was kind of a cool idea. Unfortunately, one of those astronauts, Gus Grissom, ended up dying 2 years later on the Apollo 1. There was a fire. So, it was actually fascinating to have these guys come to town. And as far as I could tell, it was the first time the city really welcomed on a big scale astronauts home.
You talk about confetti. You talk about a 15-car motorcade. I mean, that's a lot. And this is for, let's see, what did I say? 4 hours, 52 minutes, and 31 seconds orbiting the Earth three times. And this is the reaction it got. So then, you know, you write about these various NASA missions. And in the beginning here, I mean, I'm not going to say it's like it happened every other month, but it almost happened every other month. You go from March 30th, 1965 to June 14th, 1965 for the next event, which is 4 hours in space with James McDivitt and Edward White, including the first spacewalk. And they came to town. And once again, the city rolls out the welcome mat, not quite as, not to the extent that they did previously, but as, you know, because this is getting to be, at that point, a regular event. But tell us about what you call the quote-unquote, or what the Tribune reported as the quote-unquote, made a tactical slip. What is that?
One of the astronauts, James McDivitt, he was actually born here at St. Mary of Nazareth Hospital. So we have this great photo of this massive cake that looks like, I don't know, a lunar capsule or a space capsule or something.
Yeah.
And he's standing next to it. But yeah, he said something he probably shouldn't have said. And again, this is a bunch of students gathered at the Airy Crown Theater to listen to what the astronauts have to say, to ask questions. And so somebody asked a question, something about, he said there were enough qualified men to handle America's space flights. He said the addition of women, quote, could create a lot of problems. So I don't know how well or not well that was received back in the day, because astronauts were all male back then. I think that was one thing as I was going through the archives I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah, we got a quote here that you wrote. Hit McDivitt said, there are a lot of women in the program. They don't have to be astronauts. They're astronauts. Come on. There are a lot of other things that can be done by women, according to this McDivitt. Now, that is 1965. Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, things have changed drastically. Maybe not as much as they should, but they certainly have. Both genders seem to be involved in almost every aspect of NASA these days. And they should be. As I said earlier, just a few minutes ago, it's go March 30th, 1965, June 14th, 1965, January 14th, 1969. This is humans to the moon and back. You've got Frank Borman, James Lovell from Lake Forest, and William A. Anders spend 6 days. What were they doing during those 6 days?
They were up there getting things ready. I find it fascinating that with all of these different missions, you know, each one is making a little bit of progress, a little bit more progress. And so they were up there, you know, getting stuff ready for the subsequent Apollo missions. But one thing that a lot of people remember is the Earthrise photograph that was taken by this crew before they splashed down in the Pacific. And they also celebrated Christmas up in space with freeze-dried turkey and gravy. It was kind of bad timing to have a parade in Chicago just a few weeks after they got back because it was January.
Right.
It was in January. But thousands of people still turned out. They had the ticker tape parade that actually started on the Kennedy Expressway and went all the way through the loop.
Wow.
And so the astronauts themselves, from what was reported in the Tribune, were really appreciative of people turning up to see them. And we know Jim Lovell, who lived here in Lake Forest for a really long time would go back up into space. So this is one of several times we get to see him celebrated for the work that he did.
Corey Moore, we're going to take a break and go back to outer space when we come back on 720 WGN. From Deadline USA, 1952 with Humphrey Bogart, we return to Corey Moore from the Chicago Tribune, talking about vintage Chicago Tribune, which is your one of the things that you contribute to the Chicago Tribune. Why don't you give it a plug right now so we'll make sure we get it in?
Oh, thank you, John.
Sure.
Yeah, you can find me on ChicagoTribune.com. But if you want to sign up for my newsletter, you can go to ChicagoTribune.com/newsletters. And like John said, I'm the one that's called Vintage Chicago Tribune. You can sign up for it, or you can search for my name on the website. You can find my stuff either way, or find me on social media, too.
And then, oh, yes, with increasing regularity, I might add. I've noticed
that. I know. I'm trying.
No, you're doing a great job with this.
No.
Hey, I would have forgotten all about Lee Ilya if I hadn't seen your post. Come on.
Thanks, John.
I mean, that's got to take extra time, right?
Oh, yeah. Fun stuff, though. It's all fun. It's just finding different ways to get the information to the people, you know?
That's... Well said, journalism major. So we've been following Corey's article that concerns itself with the United States space program and the various moments in history that things occurred and how they were received in Chicago. Ticker tape parades, 15-car motorcades. Starting in March 30th, 1965, we worked our way through June 14th, 1965, January 14th, 1969. The reception was...
Yeah, we did that one, too.
Oh, we did that one, too. Oh, okay, so now we're going to move to... These are still happening with such regularity. It's unbelievable.
That was part of the idea with putting this together. One of our photo editors, Andrew Johnston, suggested it because we all felt after Artemis II, it was an uplifting thing, right?
Exactly.
See, like, oh, the moon. We all just felt so wonderful about it. And so it made me curious. And he was like, hey, how often did astronauts come to Chicago and how did people react to it? And I said, I got to make that a newsletter. And so now we're coming on up to the Apollo 11 mission, which I think was the largest turnout. According to the city, something like 2 million people turned up to see the Apollo 11 astronauts who, of course, were the first to land on the moon and to two out of three walked on the moon. So, yeah, huge.
Yeah. And then what happens after that? You have Apollo. Oh, Apollo 13. Yeah. That did not go that well. That was the one that's the infamous Houston, we have a problem mission.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well,
so everybody was tense and glued to their TV to see what would happen to the astronauts. And thankfully, they landed safely and were invited to come to Chicago. And they showed up. Jim Lovell again.
Yes.
Huge deal.
Yeah, and it was immortalized in a very successful, popular film where Lovell was portrayed by Tom Hanks.
That's right.
I think that movie's been seen by a lot of people. It's a great film.
Really good movie.
And luckily, everything more or less turned out. The mission became secondary to the welfare of the astronauts because... It was one of the rare times in these days of the space program where something wasn't right. And it worked out well, or at least safely.
Thank goodness.
Let's put it that way. And Jim Lovell went on to open a restaurant in Lake Forest, I think.
I did not know that.
I think so. I'm pretty sure. You know who knows? Bob Surratt knows.
Ooh.
Yeah, I know
Wake
he did. I know he did. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, I think I made a joke about it once. Global's restaurant. It was great, but it didn't have any atmosphere. Anyway, the food was great, but it didn't have any atmosphere. That was it, yeah. You know, Bob knows. Bob, yeah, Bob knows. So where are we in this progression of NASA
sending people into space? We get all the way to 1972. Yeah. Yeah, it's like Apollo 16 by that point. I mean, I can't imagine at that point what it must have been like, because it's like, okay, you got guys landing on the moon for the fifth time, and what are they doing now? Just what?
And you know, it hasn't even been a decade. March 30th, 1965. Right. We're at May 17th, 1972. All of this is happening within, you know, seven or eight, 9 years. I mean, yeah. With great regularity.
Were you trying to figure out who the crew was on Apollo 13?
No, but you can go ahead and do that.
Oh, okay. And let's see, Jim Lovell,
yes.
Jack Swigert, and Fred Hayes.
Right.
Those were the three.
Yeah. And we were mentioning, of course, the movie. Apollo 13.
Yes.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. So, where are we now? I mean, I know where we are now, but where are we in the context?
Oh, my goodness.
Although people listening to this show sometimes wonder, where is he? Anyway, but
all right, where are we? Last one, 1974. So, this is when NASA's 9 astronauts for Skylab, which was the U.S.'s first space station.
Yes.
This is when they received a parade in Chicago. And it's sad because at that point, it's like, you know, you don't have millions of people turning out. You've got a few old cars that the astronauts and their wives are riding around in. And it's like you said, I mean, it's only 1974.
I know.
It hadn't been that long. But I wish we would still do these types of things. I'm sure astronauts now, they're busy. They've got a lot going on. It's hard to get them to come to the city.
Like you said, it was the Artemis was something that most people, I think, and, you know, thought was great. And I believe just right after that, the government cut NASA's budget by $25 million. So,
jeez.
So you have, so that's that.
That's that.
Whatever that means, someone else can come to a conclusion. But,
right.
Yeah. So that's it. Yeah. I mean, you know, you're talking about a confetti to the in the beginning to, riding around a bunch of old cars with a few thousand people within 10 years. I mean, it's like, to me, it's like movie sequels to a certain extent.
Yes.
I mean, you can only go back to the story a few times before it begins to become too familiar, really.
Agreed.
I mean, it doesn't take anything away from its achievements or the, what's involved in the part of the space program. You know, making these missions successful. And look now, we've got like private rockets going up. I mean, Elon Musk sends rockets into the air that go up and then come right back down to the same spot. I mean, it's just a whole it's a whole different universe, he said. You know what I mean? It's just become, it's not just a government thing. It's privatized. I guess that's the word to use. So maybe one of these days there will be, I don't know. You know, the idea was, will there be a mission to Mars? Well, you know, I don't know. Do we really need to go to Mars? That's a whole different question.
I am all for the spirit of discovery and, you know, creativity and trying to figure out what is out there that we don't know, because there is so much out there that we don't know. So that part of it I love. And like I said, with Artemis too, it just made me really appreciate that sense of wonder. And so we might just have to find something else to get our discovery kick for a while.
Needless to say, well, this is maybe obvious, but you don't really have any preconceived notion of what it is that you're going to find when you go into the archives, do you? Or do you?
No, No. And a bunch of the time, like if I'm working with somebody else in the newsroom, they say, oh, for sure, we have something about this in the archive, right? And I said, no, there's no guarantee that, you know, the Chicago Tribune has been around since 1847. There's no guarantee that anything is still going to be where it's supposed to be in our archive, even though we have this expansive archive. So I just never know what I'm going to find. My newsletter tomorrow is I'm going to be looking back at the wettest months in Chicago history to find some flood photos.
Perfect.
And yes, it's been a very wet April. So I figured it would be fun to look back.
The wettest months.
Yeah.
I got a feeling that will be talked about on the air tomorrow night. Trust me.
Yeah.
It's a big weather night. Thursday's a big weather night on the John Landecker program, no matter what the weather is. It's our major weather hunk. That's what we do. So, that's going to be fabulous. Yes. Today, I don't know. I was cold, quite frankly.
And I did
not enjoy that.
No, me neither. Yeah. Especially after it was so nice and warm last week. So, I agree.
All right, Corey, it's great to talk to you as usual. And I can't wait to do it again. Thanks for being with us.
You too, John. Anytime. Thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. Thanks. Corey Remore from the Chicago Tribune.